This is a podcast from the Rhodes Trust, which was recorded live at the 110th Rhodes Anniversary in Oxford. In this edition, Sir Frank Berman, Professor Nyree Woods and Ambassador R. James Woolsey discuss whether democracy and human rights can be internationally imposed by armed force.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're ready to start, so if you're ready to start, let's get going. Thank you for joining the other specimens in the museum. I was tempted to say that it's typical of Oxford, isn't it, that you take a subject of the most live, active, burning international concern and you schedule the discussion of it in a museum reeking faintly of formaldehyde. Anyhow, our subject is the subject we have is the subject of intervention internationally. It's a subject of baffling complexity. So we decided against the idea of trying to turn this into a debate in which you had pros and cons. We don't expect any of the speakers on the panel to adopt, a global single position on a subject that's so complex. So don't take the title too seriously. Don't even worry about the misprint, the intrusion of the S after force. It was meant to be through armed force, not armed forces. It's not meant to be an attempt to turn so complex a subject into one simple catchphrase slogan. And I hope, as do my co-panelists, that it's going to allow ample scope for discussion, not just of military force, but of intervention in the roundest sense, with all of the alternatives. And we could hardly have a better qualified pair of panelists to take up a subject of that kind. On my left, I have Professor Nyree Woods, distinguished expert in international relations, Rhodes trustee, and the founding dean, if that's the right term, of the Blavatnik School of Government. And on my right, Jim Woolsey, who has served administrations of both political hues in the USA with decisive service in disarmament and a spell as the head of the Director of Central Intelligence. So we could hardly be better qualified. My own background is in international law and diplomacy. I'm here largely as the agent provocateur to make quite sure we get lots of debate going. And in any case, I'm a diplomat, so you know perfectly well that what I say can't be taken as true. And please don't believe everything I do choose to say for the sake of debate today. The theme for the discussion was, of course, triggered by Syria, which was in the forefront of all of our minds. It's not intended to be limited to Syria, far from it, but a generalization of that theme. But let's do a little mood-setting exercise. Take a straw poll, but you have to think yourself back about 2 weeks. So the question is, are you, or better still, were you, in favor of military intervention? And I better, I suppose, improve upon that by saying Western military intervention in Syria. So those saying yes, hands up, please. And those saying no. Good, that's good. Now I'm going to pose you another little exercise. Let's assume that 2 weeks ago, President Obama had got to the point of following through on his announced intention of putting a request for authority to the Congress. And let's assume now that you're a member of the US Congress. Would you have voted in favor of giving the president the authority he was seeking? Those yes. Those against? Now, it's interesting, you see, I asked for that because we see a slightly different picture emerging across the room on those two different versions of more or less the same proposition, which has political reverberations of its own. But let's get into our subject, which, as I say, is not by any means devoted exclusively to Syria, where the position has changed enormously over the course of the last 2 weeks and is still changing today. But let's get onto the question and here I'm going to turn, I think, first to Nyree Woods. What are the international values, whether they're social values, political values or moral values that enter realistically into the scope of one's thinking when one's talking about external intervention?
So, well, for me, there's legal norms and there's the politics of it. And I think I'd just like to say one quick thing about each. Because I think there's a good reason why in international law there is, on the one hand, a prohibition against armed attacks on other sovereign states, except whether it is in self-defense or where there is international agreement in the Security Council. And I think there's a very good reason for that prohibition on armed attacks, including in Syria. And that's a political reason, which is, first, that we know from history that when outsiders attack another country to bring about political change, you very quickly realize that many, and most populations, would often prefer their own dictator to an externally imposed so-called democrat. And, you know, we saw that in Belgrade when the bridges of Belgrade were bombed and the activists who had fought so valiantly against Milosevic joined with the pro-Milosevic forces to stand on those bridges with peace signs on their chests. It was just a poignant moment to remember that most populations do not want to see something externally imposed. And to me, a second very important consideration is the fact that life is not Hollywood. There aren't good guys and bad guys, where the good guys are always on one side and the bad guys are always on the other. There are political movements on both sides, which always involve extremists and moderates. Whether it's in the neoconservative movement in the United States, where you have extremists and moderates, or whether it's in political movements like the rebels in Syria, where there are extremists and moderates. And that any intervention has to take into account which side, which part of each movement is being given free hand by the intervention. So to me, I'm quite a non-interventionist, and I quite support the UN Charter prohibiting on intervention. But just as a last point, want to also highlight the international imperative to intervene to protect egregious abuses of human rights, so the Convention on Genocide, because that's where I think intervention is justified. But it's protective intervention, and it's intervention that at its best permits a population subsequently, with less fear and less violence, to plan its own future.
Jim Woolsey, let me turn to you. When do things become so critical, so severe, that outside intervention comes seriously into question as part of the political calculation?
I think generally it would be when there are something like what is taking place in Syria now, essentially crimes against humanity, genocide and something approaching it. Intervention just to change a country's constitutional structure, I don't really think it happens. Look at the 116 countries that Freedom House now lists as electoral democracies. 26 of those are what's called partly free, like, say, Pakistan. The rest are what Freedom House calls free. And so we've got 116 countries in the world that elect their leaders and so forth. Those countries have chosen democracy in one way or another. And they are at least electoral democracy. And the numbers indicate that they are, even the poor ones, across the board, more prosperous, less warlike, have better supplies of drinking water, better youth mortality, and not as much youth deaths of children, and so forth. It goes on and on. Why would a country not pick a government where they can work in terms of consensus? But if they don't, and that's all that's going on, it's their problem, I looked through the 116 countries very carefully yesterday to see if I could find one where the United States had forced them to have democracy. I think you might say that was true of Grenada, when we went into Grenada in 83.
And we objected, don't forget.
Yes, well, the Brits are always commenting on so. I think that's a possibility, but that wasn't why we went into Grenada. We went into Grenada because the Grenadians were letting the Cubans build a huge military airstrip. And we said, hey, nah, we don't want you to do that. But if the Grenadians afterwards had said, well, okay, you knocked out the airstrip, by the way, we've decided we want to be a Tibetan theocracy or a colony of Greenland or whatever, what would have been the American response? No, read the Federalist Papers and write the right kind of constitution? Nah, I don't care. Let them do what they want to do. So this business of intervening in order to establish a form of government with supporting human rights and democracy is not what happens. The interventions occur for other reasons. Why do they occur? Well, my first day of international law some years ago at Yale Law School, Professor Leon Lipson had a rather remarkable opening couple of sentences to the class. He said, the main thing I want you to take away today is that this is the only subject international law that you will study in law school in which a genuine and reasonable disagreement exists between reasonable people about whether or not the subject exists at all. And the reason is there's no sheriff. And there's still no sheriff. There's the Security Council of the United Nations. But I tell you, if you review the old movie, and there are some circumstances Hollywood reflects reality pretty well. If you review the old movie, High Noon, and notice how the townspeople act in trying to figure out whether they can get anybody to help the marshal keep the bad guys from taking over the town again. The answer is they kind of resemble the UN Security Council on a bad day. And in terms of actually deciding, okay, it's come down to this. We have four guys with guns arriving, and they're going to be walking down the street at noon, and they're going to establish their regime dominating the town and killing whomever they want to as before. Who's going to stop them? You look around for the sheriff, and the sheriff has just finished his job. It was his last day yesterday, and he and his new wife could head off out of town. Now, that's not what happens. But it's because he decides to continue to functionally be the sheriff, even though he's not obligated to. I would suggest the fundamental problem of this area is not, is there too little or too much intervention to establish democracy and human rights? Almost nobody intervenes in their countries to do that. They intervene in order to protect themselves and their allies against dictators, authoritarians, autocrats, totalitarians, like Assad.
Well, I want to come back to the question of who decides, because I think that's one of the critical elements in this whole discussion. But we've had the proposition that there aren't exclusive. It's not a caricature. There aren't good guys and bad guys. Same is true on the platform, by the way. I think my co-panelists, for all their real-world experience, are wildly unrealistic, because Nairi thinks you can have a surgical intervention, which you intervene like an operation, and having cut out the disease part, you withdraw, and the body then starts functioning again, as if you would close off that episode. Jim, on the other hand, says nobody wants to intervene to oppose the constitution, change the government, but that elides the whole question of what is it that you're trying to do? What is the disease you're trying to attract? What is the tactical objective in order to do that? And what are the means you're going to use to do it? I'm still scarred, if you like the word, by the experience of Iraq in 2003, not a war we want to refight. But you remember the proposition was, Iraqi weapons of mass destruction had been proscribed by the Security Council. Iraq had been defying the international community and the inspection regime over its obligations to destroy. So there was an intervention which was supposed to be exactly what Jim was talking about, townspeople stepping in when the sheriff wasn't there because the Security Council had not shown itself in agreement. But to do what? The method chosen to remove the weapons of mass destruction was to overthrow the regime. So I think that there's a degree of well-meaning naivety there. But let's get on to the real subject, which is what are the issues that, in our minds, as responsible world citizens, justify external intervention. Now, do you want to list a few issues that would bring this into play? Syria, it's been chemical weapons, the use of chemical weapons. What other kinds of questions? And then I'm going to ask people from the floor whether they've got suggestions of their own.
So I opened talking about genocide and egregious abuses of human rights by the state, and therefore which a population finds itself at a loss to defend themselves. But I actually think that the essence of this question and the difficulty in it lies not so much in the triggering issue. It lies in what happens then. It lies in the political actions of the issue. You know, I want to put to Jim the question, how is it that we, when the United States does act as volunteer sheriff, that we prevent the rationale for intervention becoming the credibility of the President of the United States, which is what we nearly saw 2 weeks ago? Because that's an incredibly dangerous step, where you move from having a reason to intervene to having a leader that says that he or she will intervene, and then the question no longer becomes, can we achieve what we are setting out to do? It becomes, can we afford to lose credibility as the British government or as the American government? And suddenly the purpose and the outcome of the intervention is lost. In my view, the most egregious failure in Iraq and in the decision-making around Syria 2 weeks ago was the absence of deep military advice to the President of the United States, to the Prime Minister of Britain, before they began to commit publicly to doing something. What we're seeing is politicians saying, I'm going to do something, we're going to do something, without first really working out exactly what it is that they are capable of doing, and then becoming trapped in this idea that they have to do something or their credibility is at loss. So I admit that there can be good intentions at the beginning of that chain, but the risk is that those good intentions very quickly become a road to extremely poorly executed intervention, which empowers fundamentalists on both sides.
Which is where we come into national politics and political perception, to public perception. But Jim, do you want to answer that one?
I think the way to avoid having the president look like a goofball is for him to focus on substance rather than public relations. If what you're doing is managing your, quote, narrative, as they say, and trying to get good press, substantive things will get crossed up. Let me give you an example of someone who did it right. An administration I served in. Bill Clinton felt terrible after the massacres in Rwanda because he thought he could have stopped them, and he's right, a few Marine armed helicopters probably could have. He had stayed away because Black Hawk Down had been such a public relations shock that he didn't feel he could get involved in something like that again, but as a result of our not doing anything, as a result of no one else's doing anything, horrible massacre in Rwanda. A few years after that, in 99, the Serbs were killing Kosovars pretty much at will. And Clinton decided, this time I'm going to do it right. He went to the United Nations. The Security Council of the United Nations said, nah. He went to the US Congress, and by one vote in the House of Representatives, the Congress of the United States said, nah. So what did he do? He acted like Gary Cooper at High Noon. He said, well, okay, but I'm not going to have any more massacres of Kosovars. He ordered the U.S. Air Force and U.S. Navy into action. We had about a 55-day bombing campaign of Kosovo. Milosevic died in prison, and there's a Bill Clinton Avenue in Pristina. Now, that was a last resort. But he decided, I think properly, that if nobody else was going to be the sheriff, and there was going to be a lot of killing, just as there had been in Rwanda, no. No. I don't care, basically, he said. If the Security Council of the Congress says no, I have the authority under our Constitution as President of the United States to stop this, I'm going to do it. Now, to my mind, that's the tough issue. If you don't have authority from some institution to be the sheriff, but by any reasonable calculation, a sheriff is needed, will somebody step forward? In this case, it was Clinton.
Now, that's wonderful. I said my key question was, who decides? And I still think it is the cardinal question. It's now bifurcated wonderfully because it's who decides internationally and also who decides nationally, which I'd like to come on to again in a moment. But we're still with the question of when. The mantra that we heard, Nairi said the wrong thing was that it was decided that something had to be done and there was no pre-planning. So the military planners then had to start thinking the thing out afterwards. The mantra we kept on hearing, chemical weapons are horrible, we can't stand by and do nothing. Didn't we hear that again and again and again in the USA, in Britain, throughout Europe, and I would guess in the rest of the world too? So let me take another quick opinion poll from the floor. What are the issues in which you can say we can't stand by and do nothing? There are some roving microphones, so if you want to add to the list of abuses, please, there's a microphone coming your way. And not a speech, just give us some examples.
Chris Maxwell, Victoria, 1975. I wanted to draw your attention to the responsibility to protect resolution of the United Nations General Assembly in, I think, 2005 as a basis for suggesting that the distinction between killing your population by chemical weapons more recently and killing them by any other means is an immaterial distinction for the purpose of the trigger for humanitarian intervention. And I would have thought of that resolution said, it's as soon as you can say that the government is substantially killing, prejudicing, trying to wipe out its population, that's the trigger for intervention. My concern is that the terrible mistakes in Iraq have made us much more reluctant to intervene when we should.
Anyone else? The microphone's still there. Here's somebody in the front, in the middle.
Thank you. Bill McGill from Ontario, 62. My problem with this is the problem of war. It's getting a bad name. I don't really believe you're entitled to go and kill people in other countries unless the future of yourself and your own country and your own family is clearly at stake. If you're not under that kind of threat, kill or be killed, I think there's an old maxim that goes way back that says, thou shalt do no murder. And I think maybe that's one of the very few ways to keep a small group of people from perishing in the desert. It may be a very good way to keep people from perishing in the modern world. I think there's only one justification. If we're talking about somebody doing something elsewhere, if somebody goes in Toronto with a machine gun, thank heavens we don't do that in Canada, but if somebody does do that and slaughters 25 people, we don't kill them, we put them in jail. And I think that same kind of right should apply throughout the world. Why are we allowed to go and kill people in the third world if we don't kill them at home for the same crime?
Point. Just in a second, let's see. Is there anyone else who wants to add? There on the right. The microphone's coming to you, sir.
My name is Sajjad Pakistan, and born in 1964. The question you posed was, should we stand by if chemical weapons are used to kill innocent people? I want to ask you, Would you make a distinction between killing people, innocent people, by drones and killing them through chemical weapons? And if so, why?
Well, I think that's exactly the question that many of us have been asking. But Jim, you wanted to comment on.
Yes. There's a difference, I think, that has to do with whether or not you are willing to absorb or to take on your shoulders responsibility, even though not authorized by someone else. There was a British Prime Minister who had exactly the view, in many ways a great man, who had exactly the view that unless the threat is here at home to us, then it's a small country far away. His name was Neville Chamberlain. And he didn't really advance the cause of humanity and justice by standing by, nor did we. We were standing by. That's our being 3 years late to World War I and 2 years late to World War II is the source of Churchill's marvelous line that the Americans always do the right thing, but unfortunately only after they've exhausted all other possibilities. And you can sit and debate yourself for a long time. Or you can do, again, Hollywood, what Gary Cooper did in High Noon, and what Bill Clinton did in Kosovo, which is say, you know, like Isaiah, who shall go and who shall go for us? Here am I, Lord, send me. Either you think that way or you don't. What you can't do is say, we ought to make sure these terrible guys, the Hitlers as they're getting going and so forth, get stopped, right? And then you look around and find anybody who's willing to pick up a gun, anybody who is willing to deploy forces, and sometimes it's very hard to find. It was certainly very hard to find in the 1930s.
And I guess for me to engage in a debating format, so the difference between the Wild West and the modern day for me lies in the careful building of due process. It lies in a careful consideration about how we balance the need to enforce law on the one hand, but the need to protect citizens from the king or queen that wants to behead them because they displease the king or queen, or the cowboy sheriff that just wants to shoot the guy because he wants his house, his wife, his horse, his cow. Due process, therefore, becomes really important and always very irritating to those trying to do their best to enforce the rule of law. So irritating for a police person to find that for some small legal process reason, somebody who they know to be clearly guilty gets off. But think about why we have those processes. And that, to me, takes us to the issue of drone warfare, and I'd just like to respond to that. Because my concern was truly sparked when we saw drones being used to assassinate American citizens who were seen to be siding with Al-Qaeda in foreign territories. Because if a country takes upon itself to assassinate its own citizens, for actions without any process, without any due process, is that not eroding the fabric of actually what the system is that we're trying to protect? I think it's hugely problematic, not just problematic for a state to be assassinating its own citizens without due process, but also problematic that modern drone and airstrike warfare takes a whole calculation out of a decision to go to war. 300 years ago, political leaders had to lead the charge into battle. They had to get on a horse and go first, which I think is a really important and powerful constraint on the easy use of war. And I do often wonder if our political leaders had to be the first into the cockpit of the first flight in, the first people with boots on the ground, how that might change their decision-making of how and when to use political force. And then just finally a comment on what I really like about the responsibility to protect discussions, So those who hate them say, ah, oh, this is classic talking shop, United Nations, about, you know, hundreds of different people with hundreds of different voices talking and talking and talking to no effect. Well, I don't take that view, actually. That conversation has been going on for 200 years in the wars of law, in the laws of war conversations, right through to the current day conversations. And I think there's something extraordinarily precious in that, which is countries and cultures coming together to really debate what is it that they care about so much that they are willing communally to protect. And I think the responsibility to protect discussion is therefore, in my view, a very important one, which I don't toss into the bin because there's no clear sheriff on a horse and there's no clear collective international force that can go in and back it up.
Well, I almost raised lone chair a moment ago because the phrase the rule of law appeared. Good, I'm glad the phrase the rule of law has appeared. I'm going to pass the microphone back to the floor, but in the meanwhile, I just want to say that Jim's two cases are not the same. High Noon and Kosovo are not the same. High Noon is a classic example of self-defense, and the ordinary citizen, too, faced with an assailant with a weapon, is entitled to resort to force that otherwise would not be permitted in self-defense. Kosovo was not self-defense. Kosovo was justified, to the extent the justification holds, by rescuing people from misery. How you can rescue people from misery by bombing from the air is a different question entirely, and that's a question of means, not objectives, but the cases are not the same. And that's the problem with the Neville Chamberlain analogy, isn't it? That once you start translating a situation well away from home into a threat, and you construct an argument that a threat a long way away from home is immediate and demands a response, you run those two cases together as if they were one and the same, and I don't think they are. But I've got lots of people from the floor, and we'll come back to our panelists.
Mr. Moderator, you do have a plot of High Noon wrong. I'll be glad to correct you.
Good. Good. Can we get the microphones one round? There's a gentleman right there in...
Thank you. Varun Sivaram, California Zen Chunk, 2011. Dr. Woods, you disagreed with the Top Shop characterization of responsibility to protect. If so, can both of you look into your crystal balls and tell us over the next 10, 50, 100 years, if there's going to be a new legal basis for intervention, how's it going to come about? How will it be in front?
Let's move it around. The gentleman in the blue shirt behind you, and then the lots more people in the middle.
Larry Pressler, St. Edmund Hall, 64. Nicholas Kristof's article this morning takes the humanitarian side, a lady in the area that where there was gas in Syria, but what bothers her much more is the missiles that have been coming in. Another article in this morning's paper talked about how Great Britain, although they voted against the going to war, this month there were several arms export sales to all sides that end up on all sides, and Britain is a major exporter of arms, according to this article, and is doing it to all sides in Syria. So I think that we have a false thing at these conferences and in the whole discussion. We talk about soft power, as Lord Patton did last night, but in reality, we're kind of fooling the people because we're talking, we all want to emanate that we're for soft power and this and that, and this horrible nerve gas and so forth, but the other stuff is just the same. So I would say there aren't any, nerve gas shouldn't be treated any different than any of the others. And everybody always criticizes the USA, and so do I, but Great Britain voted against going to war this very month, but yet they're, read the morning's paper that I was handed, they are exporting large amounts of arms, selling them to all sides.
Let's move the microphone on, then I'm going to come to the other side too, and I haven't lost the front row either. Can we bring the mic down?
That's from Germany, 1976. I want to add another dimension, not just the beginning of the war, but also what comes afterwards. And what we've seen in Iraq is that today we see 30 to 70 people getting killed, because the town people, you know, after having been rescued from those four villains, are killing each other. And the Christian population has been essentially wiped out. And so what have we brought with the intervention? And the same seems to be potentially happening in Syria and maybe at some stage in Egypt and so forth. So you intervene to help the good people, and in the end, you know, what you have is civil war and a lot of killings going on for many years, and the townspeople who were protected initially or supposed to be protected initially really suffer very badly.
James Taylor, Ontario and Balliol, 1951. It's ironic, I think, that if at the moment the United States and Russia are cooperating to some degree over the Syrian problem, that is a sign that what was originally intended under the Charter is working. Much of the history, of course, has been the reverse of the frustration of the original design and of attempts to find solutions. And if you go back and examine the history of various security crises since the war, there are many examples of different solutions found to circumvent the problem of the veto. Just to give two examples now lost in the past. The Korean War was fought under something called Uniting for Peace, which was a device, a procedural device to circumvent the veto. Well, that was a major war, after all, a major application of force by the international community. Then there was a time when China was not in the Chinese seat. The nationalist government still was. And there was a peace settlement that had to be worked out when the French had lost their war in Indochina. And it was necessary that China be one of the guarantors. But China was not a member of the UN. So there was a conference, an international conference, established that set up a different device, a coalition of, it would have been called retrospectively a coalition of the willing to establish a ceasefire in Indochina. More recently, we've come to humanitarian interventions. These interventions in the dim past were really interventions that had to do with threats to international security. But more recently, we've tried to deal collectively with humanitarian intervention. And if you look at the responsibility to protect doctrine, you see that there are various stipulations, there are conditions that should be met before the doctrine is acted on. And one of them is that you must consider whether after your intervention, the outcome will be an improvement or not, whether you're going to do more harm than good. And I think that should lead to great hesitation and thoughtfulness before many of the situations that might call otherwise for an intervention.
And could we at that point move the microphone on, because I need to get it around the room and back up to the...
I'll finish in one sentence. That means that the situation would have to be an egregious violation.
I want to say Lindsay Sands, Montana, 1988, and I just have a question to you, Gary. Egregious humanitarian, or egregious human rights abuses. How do you decide when you've crossed that line? So our colleague Susan Rice is obviously deep into this at the moment, was active in the Libya situation, which I don't know if that crossed that line or not, but we sat years aside with Darfur doing nothing. And so I wonder when human rights and the national, you know, national interests overlap, and how you make that decision when it's, we can't fight all of these battles all over the world. So how do you decide which ones matter?
Afzal Mufti, Pakistan, Supreme Court, 67. My submission is, taken from the experience of President Clinton's intervention, that when public perceives an intervention to be based on sound judgment and not lies, and the result is satisfactory, both to the domestic population and to the international community, the decision is seen to be sound and effective and gives rise to future possibilities of the same kind. Kosovo, possibly Afghanistan, removal of the Taliban, but Iraq, both the American public and the British public were lied to comprehensively. This is what they have not forgiven their leaders for. Those who live here know how popular Tony Blair is today. If the decision process is transparent, it's based on fact, truth, the public will support intervention to safeguard against humanitarian disasters, against the use of weapons of mass destruction, against chemical weapons. But when the public perceive the leaders to be hiding things or making up things to attack other countries, things go out of control.
There's one more over here, and then I'm going to bring it back to the panel.
I have one question.
Can you lift your card up to your mouth?
How and when do you think the UN or the international community should help a country reinstate a democracy after a dictatorship has fallen? For example, in Egypt, after the fall of Mubarak, now it's been a few years of chaos, and now it's right back to a military dictatorship. So when do you think that should stop and the international community should come in to instate a true democracy?
Thanks very much indeed. I'm going to come back to the panel now. There are two questions that I think are coming out of this discussion we haven't addressed yet. One, which we've had twice over, is intervention only right when it succeeds? Is it one of those cases where if you do it properly, it's okay, but if you don't, it isn't? And forgive me for sounding a little bit cynical, but that is the implication behind some of the things that have been said. And the other one is, if we're still on that mantra of we can't stand by and do nothing, who are the we? Nairi, do you want to say who are the we? We've had the case where the international authority, the duly constituted international authority, isn't speaking properly, isn't exercising what's supposed to be its duty under that crass evasion, the responsibility to protect, about which my views are fightingly strong. But never mind that. If the constituted international authority isn't doing what's expected, who are the we in substitution?
I think the two questions are inseparable. You know, your first one about is intervention only right when it succeeds, to me there's a very clear answer to, which is it's not that intervention is only right when it succeeds. It's that, as we can take from just war theory, intervention is only right when not just the ends, but the means and the likely consequences have been fully thought through. In other words, it's not enough just to have your reason for going to war, whether it's chemical weapons or responsibility to protect, whatever it is. That is never enough. You have to not just have a goal in mind or an ends, but you actually have to have demonstrated to proper effect and properly debated how it is that you are going to achieve that end and whether the damage you will cause is proportionate to the positive effects that you would have. And we saw this in the Iraq case. In my view, that was a problem. It wasn't just the lying to the population about the reason to go to war. It was the fact that those military officers and very experienced military voices who felt that militarily after what they said would be a quick victory, and they were right, militarily, you couldn't achieve the goal that the political leaders hoped. Those voices were silenced far too quickly in the United States and in the United Kingdom. They were simply put on cold storage. And that, to me, highlights the essence of weighing up what you can actually achieve. And that's why I'm so concerned with decisions to intervene that become decisions, no longer decisions to intervene, which carefully weigh those two effects, but become decisions about maintaining the credibility of the British Prime Minister.
Jim, let me pass it to you. And when you speak, could you also answer Mr. Mushti's very valid question? How do we know what we know? And how do we know in a way which can be made credible to our populations, our political constituencies?
My first day of philosophy tutorials for PPE here, H.P. Rice took me over to the window of his rooms and said, "Mr. Woolsey, look at those flowers in the garden. What color are they?" I said, "Well, they're blue, sir." I said, "Very good, come back." And he poured himself a sherry and me a sherry, and he said, "Now, Mr. Woolsey, how do you know they're blue?" And we began epistemology. This is a very difficult question. We could write books about this. People have. Let me suggest one very important point where I particularly agree with you, Gary. One needs not just to examine the going in, but also the coming out, and whether the whole process will have the effect that one wanted. That was the big failure, I think, in Iraq. I think one could have made a reasonable case, even without this alleged weapons of mass destruction, for deposing Saddam Hussein, given the circumstances and his massacres and all the rest. But once we did that, we started drafting a constitution for him. Now, Amartya Sen, using a phrase of Rawls's the Institutions of Public Reason, has a very good point. It's related to his Nobel Prize for, among other things, showing that democracies don't have famines. And the reason they don't have famines is that their institutions can react and deal with situations a lot better than dictatorships and authoritarian regimes. And if you use or let a civilization or society use its own institutions of public reason, as Mongolia has. Has anybody drafted a constitution for Mongolia? No. They're relying on their tribal history and so forth, and they've turned it into a democracy. If you permit that to happen, then you're far more likely to succeed. Bernard Lewis and I wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal in the fall of 2003, a few months after the intervention, when people were starting to draft constitutions for Iraq. And we said, wait a minute. The Iraqis have a perfectly fine constitution. It's a constitutional monarchy. It has an elected lower house. It has fair treatment for everybody. It's a good constitution. There'd have to be some changes, but it has an amendment procedure. It was taken away from them by the Baathists in 59. From 25 to 59, they had their own constitution, and it worked. Give it back to them. Could never get anybody to, the response both Bernard and I got was kind of, huh? And whether that was right in those circumstances or not, I think the key thing, and again, I say, Gary got this, I think, exactly right, is to utilize the institutions that embody in most countries some way to recognize fairness, debate, discussion, compromise, and let them build a follow-on regime rather than coming in and telling them they have to do it this way, they have to do it that way.
It seems yeah, of course, Mary, yes.
I strongly agree with what Jim is saying, and I think it reflects something that people missed about what happened in Egypt, which is what one of the questioners commented on. And that's, it gave, I found ominous the Western cheering of the military coup that brought down President Morsi. I think the President Morsi government was ineffectual, incompetent, all sorts of things. But the thing that struck me about the Morsi government was that Egypt, a country which had not had democratic constraints on its president for decades, when President Morsi tried to act unconstitutionally, and he did it several times, where he tried to just use a presidential diktat to tell Egyptians what they would do, that country's constitution prevented him. And that, to me, is something really important. You might not have liked him, his party, or what he did in Egypt, but the fact that a democratically elected president, only a few months out from the first election in that country for so long, first legitimate election, was constrained by that country's constitution from breaking it, to me was a really important fact, and one that underscored the fact that the way to get rid of President Morsi was through the electoral process. And it was if he failed to be held to account by that electoral process that you might consider cheering because somebody enforced the country's constitution on him.
What's emerging from all of this discussion is that intervention, if it's a good thing at all, has to be not massive but surgical. I made a joke about surgical intervention, but we clearly all agree on that. It's got to be minimal. We haven't had much discussion, though, on the non-military sort of intervention, and that was also behind our question about Egypt. What can the international community do? Taking as our current exemplar what's happening over Syria, where, and there I ask myself the question, because I've heard over and over again, even mild-mannered international statesmen saying there are times when diplomacy doesn't work unless it's backed by the threat of military force, which is a baffling proposition, that because of the propensity it has to lead to exactly the one thing that you want to avoid having to use. But what are the weapons available to us, Jim, other than this outright military forcible intervention?
Both Lech Walesa and Václav Havel said that there was one thing during the Cold War that the CIA did that was devastatingly effective and the best thing that we did during the Cold War: Radio Free Europe. Mm-hmm. Most people forget how important it is to shape the debate, have it occur fairly where a totalitarian or dictatorial power keeps that from happening. The world of Twitter and Facebook and all of this is changing the possibility of having free politics very much in the way that the invention of printing and Gutenberg was the source in many ways of the Protestant Reformation. If you can't read your Bible, you can't decide what you think about it. And the same thing with respect to fax machines. The CIA and AFL-CIO worked together on a major program to flood Poland with fax machines back in the very early days of faxing. Drove the communist government crazy. They couldn't keep control of information. So these information changes that happen in technology, you want to be on top of those, you want to utilize them, you want to make sure people have a fair and open opportunity to use them, and there will be very few things that are more devastating to the Assads and the rest than not being able to control information.
Nari, what do you want to contribute on the subject of other methods of persuasion, even forcible persuasion?
Yes, well, having been painted into a corner with the two of you on supporting surgical force, I want to jump out of that corner first, because I find the concept of surgical interventions deeply unsettling, because I think that what has come to be called surgical actually is just a rebalancing of the scales of what we're paying and at what cost to the other side. That there's something about, and it came out in the question about drones, about missiles, about the fact that we or the West can now intervene without the risk of loss of human life, that tips the just war calculus about what we're doing and to what end in an unfortunate way. that the collateral damage, and the terms that we use to describe the tens of thousands that we might accidentally kill in the prosecution of the surgical strike, somehow get lost in the din of the fact that nobody on our side died. So I'm also not convinced that history suggests that it's surgical strikes that permit societies to recover and build their own systems. I think there are a lot of UN peacekeeping forces that have ended up spending more than a decade in situ keeping the peace, and keeping the peace in a way that is enabling countries to rebuild, and enabling not just the youngest, the strongest, and the most extremist to push themselves to the front of the political system, but permitting communities to organize and find other ways to govern themselves. So I first want to extract myself from the surgical strike corner and say I don't think that's the way to take the debate forward and say, do we do a surgical strike or not? Are there other means? It's not that there are other means. There are only, in the end, political means to resolving the questions that we're debating. The issue of military means is only ever either a help or a hindrance to what have to end up being political processes. So to me, it's not either other means, it's that there are only political means, and the question is whether armed force can sometimes help or hinder those political negotiations.
One point, this problem is going away. There were, in 1992, I don't have the number, but a number of major conflicts and civil wars in the world. It's fallen by two-thirds since 1992. In 2009, there were 14. This problem is shrinking, and one of the main reasons it's shrinking is because there are more and more democracies in the world. In 1988, two-thirds of the states were non-democracies. By 2002, this is reversed, and two-thirds were either democracies or tending toward being democracies. The changes that have taken place over the years as a result in modern times to World War II and the replacement, yes, we did rewrite the German and Japanese and the Italian constitutions, and I'm glad we did. As a result of that and the expansion of democracy, and as a result of the reforms, particularly in the 80s, and especially beginning in 89 with the fall of the Berlin Wall, the number of democracies just keeps growing. And that, in turn, brings about what Mort Halperin and a number of writers have called democratic peace. Democracies don't fight each other. They choose up sides and argue about tariffs, but they don't fight each other. For all practical purposes, almost no examples in history, and certainly virtually none in modern history. So as the number of democracies grow, the number of conflicts go down. It's not as if this is all going to get taken away and we don't need to do anything at all, but the problem is getting far less numerous and far smaller when we don't have to deal with nearly as many or as large a share of dictators and autocrats. They're the ones who murder people.
Would that it were so. Would that it were so. Let's hope that it is. Ladies and gentlemen, the time for shilly-shallying has come to an end. We must do something. The something that I must do is bring this session to a close. Thank you very much indeed for having joined in this conversation. I think the norm of non-intervention is still alive and well, though itself under attack. Let's not forget that next year we will be commemorating the one occasion in modern history in which a tiny localized conflict exploded into a global conflict, the scars of which we still bear with us. So there clearly is some life in non-intervention, but thanks very much indeed for joining the conversation. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as we on the platform have done too.
This podcast was recorded live on Friday, the 20th of September at the Museum of Natural History. The speakers were Sir Frank Berman, Cape Province and Wadham, 1961, Professor Nyree Woods, New Zealand and Balliol, 1987, and Ambassador R. James Woolsey, Oklahoma and St. John's, 1963. To find out more, visit www.rhodeshouse.ox.ac.uk.